Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 29th day of August, 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call. And how do we wrap up a week like this one? Well, the Republicans finished up their convention on Thursday night. Donald Trump gave what was actually a very good speech, and maybe at this point it shouldn't be at all surprising. A whole heck of a lot more unifying than anything that came out of the mouths of Joe Biden or whoever's playing him on the teleprompter tape delay. Suffice it to say that the differences are, in fact, stark. At the very worst, as some have suggested, and not without some decent points to be made, Trump is sandbagging for the deep state, while Biden is nothing short of a cheerleader for outright totalitarianism, playing Vladimir Lenin to Kamala Harris's Joseph Stalin on deck. But perhaps the best summary of what's been going on this week comes from a story that came out of, well, yeah, the UK Daily Mail, also on Friday. And I'll read you the headline. You can kind of ponder the irony here. More Republicans, sick, back, senile, creepy quid pro Joe Biden. I guess they recognize a criminal of their own ilk when they see one. Scores, says the headline, of George W. Bush, John McCain, and Mitt Romney aide sign up to calls to defeat Donald Trump's, quote, toxic personality cult. Let me just put it this way. These were the people who worked for rhino candidates that were absolutely positively selected for one reason only. Well, maybe two. A, they were sellouts, but more importantly, they were really there for one major reason, to lose to the communist who was going to fundamentally transform America. And they're still working hard for that same team. And let me get this straight. This is surprising. Why? And just to bring the point home, the story says the McCain for Biden effort was led by Mark Salter, prominent author and speechwriter, who also served as chief of staff for the evil late Senator John McCain. And in the WAPO on Thursday, the man wrote about McCain's mantra and how it guided the late senator's ex-aides to endorse the senile one. Owa Tajer Kayam. Yeah, keep repeating the mantra, whom they say will act in a bipartisan way. You know what that means, don't you? Both wings of that same evil bird of prey flapping in unison to solve big problems, like the Bill of Rights, free enterprise, and what's left of the rule of law. Quote, we are convinced that Biden's election is in the deep state, national interest, unquote. And when it came to advancing totalitarianism, they said, he showed inept leadership and capitalizing on the opportunities presented by the oh-so-long-anticipated COVID-1984 pandemic, and his disinterest in promoting socialist values, which they now claim, of course, are American values. Just make sure to spell it with a K. I'll say it again, folks. For years, they tried to hide it. Now they're rubbing your muzzled faces in it. And I do have to mention this while we're at it, because it also shows at least a temporary difference. The Daily Mail made a really big deal in one of their major headlines, which says hundreds of maskless. Oh no, how dare they? No masks, you hateful racist bigots, you. Republicans crowded together on the White House lawn to watch President Donald Trump's convention speech. And his top aide even says it's safe. Well, given the circumstances. Yes, it says 1,500 guests saw the speech, and they were not properly socialist distanced, with only a few wearing masks. Furthermore, very few of them were even tested for COVID-19. Oh, and we can guarantee there have been a lot of false positives, right? Ahead of attending the Republican National Convention's big finale. All of which, they say, comes as riots, looting, and violence continue to ravage Kenosha, Wisconsin. 98% of whom, whether they're illegal or not, will no doubt vote for the senile Biden and the Fuhrer on deck, at least if they don't burn down the post office first. From the former and future Nazi Reich in Germany, this piece comes from Zero Hedge, it should surprise nobody that this happens first within the EU, because while much of the world is being forced, whether they like it or not, into mask wearing, the government of Germany, Achtung, has now announced fines as punishment for people not wearing them. Führer Angela Merkel announced during, what else, a virtual meeting on Thursday with state governors that almost the entire country will be under a 50 euro minimum, about 60 bucks, fine for breaching the Reich's national muzzle mandate. And avoid the United States, too. And could it be that even Europeans are now ahead of the United States when it comes to pushing back against tyranny on the march? Or on the goose step? Says the Activist Post, the world is rising up against the lockdown as protests mount, including a mass protest and march called Unite for Freedom at Trafalgar Square in London, taking place this Saturday, the 29th. No more lockdown, says the flyer. No social distancing, no masks, no track and trace, no health passports, no mandatory vaccinations, no new normal. Restore all human rights that have been violated. And they have a list of top world-class doctors and nurses speaking out concerning what they call the real truth on COVID-19. Nothing is more important, they say, because time is very short. The government is voting for a 2-year extension, 2 years of their emergency COVID-1984 powers coming September. The first 6 months was a disaster. The second lockdown will be devastating. And that, of course, is the plan. And while we're talking about Europe, this is either a thigh slapper or a head scratcher. Why, asked the socialist-inclined Financial Times out of London, is the anti-vaxxer movement growing during a pandemic? Yes, it flummoxes them to know that people are saying, you know, I don't trust Big Brother, nor his plandemic, nor what he intends to do to us as a result. But it's the slant here that is really fascinating. They start out talking about a Democrat named Greer McVeigh, who insists she is, quote, not an anti-vaxxer. No, not at all. She's up to date with her own immunizations. Yeah, see, she's toeing the PC line. She's had her son vaccinated when he was a child, so she's a good little slave of the state. But still, she fears the development of a vaccine for COVID-1984 because it's being dangerously rushed. In part, she believes, to improve Donald Trump's prospects ahead of the presidential election. Oh yeah, that's the spin. This situation is different, says the California communications consultant, because of the politics that have been injected into the process and the speed at which they're developing the vaccine, says the far-left supporter of the Democratic Party, quote, frankly, I don't trust this president. It just gives me pause. And Ms. McVeigh said the piece, age 53, is one of a growing number of vaccine-hesitant Americans. They'd be calling them something nastier if they weren't far enough left, folks, that have not previously identified with the anti-vaxxer movement, traditionally dominated by libertarian Republicans and those on the left who preach the benefits of alternative medicine over pharmaceuticals. But, she says, I don't fall into either category. Rather, she cites that how Trump is putting pressure on the U.S. FDA to quickly approve a vaccine before the election, just like, and she cites this as evidence, the FDA decided to allow the use of the deadly, dreaded drug hydroxychloroquine, touted by the president, before it performed what the FT deemed a U-turn after several studies, all of them bogus to the core, folks, showed that it did not benefit patients. I note that they don't even mention the legions of others, including lots of doctors who'd used it with virtual 100% effectiveness in a treatment regime combining it with zinc and an antibiotic like Z-Pak. They do, though, cut to the chase and say what's important here is that we're looking at one of the biggest mass immunization programs in history. Two vaccines, they tout breathlessly, have already been approved, one in almost totalitarian Russia and another in totally totalitarian communist China. While aid are in the final stages of clinical testing, says Heidi Larson, and they quote her at length, director of the Vaccine Confidence Project at the London School of Hygiene and etc., anti-vaccination sentiment is going into the mainstream. A lot of people you would never have imagined are now saying that maybe the anti-vaccination lobby has a point, unquote, and ooh, they need to nip that in the bud, and the FT is certainly happy to help. And, of course, they're happy to do that by telling us about anti-vaxxers, whose videos have millions of views as they push conspiracy theories. So, for example, they quote Harvey Feinberg, chair of a committee on COVID-1984 set up by the National Academy of Sciences, who says, I'm concerned about people resisting immunization for irrational reasons, like they don't trust a fast-tracked vaccine that's never been properly tested and has never actually been shown to work against any cold or coronavirus before in history. Well, quote, based on generic distrust of anything the president says. Well, that, at least, gets closer to the truth. Yeah, and here they quote the polls. As the pandemic has continued, U.S. citizens, maybe because they can see through the BS they're being fed, have become less confident about the safety of a vaccine or about anything else that they're being mandated to do, perhaps. Polling by YouGov in May found that about 55% of U.S. adults said back then they would take the poke, but by the end of July, that figure had dropped to 41%, well below, say, experts, the 60 to 70% public health figure that these same experts say is needed to achieve herd immunity. Well, we've heard the rest of the tripe in this article before, and as you know, Big Brother's paying for research on how to break down your resistance and get you to bend over and take this one, whether it's actually properly tested or not, and they've got all kinds of propaganda on tap to assure just that, including, evidently, the Financial Times. But there is a quote in here from a professor of so-called public health at Harvard University that at least summarizes a whole lot of the smoke going on here. Listen to this, folks. Quote, it would be very difficult to push people to get vaccinated with heavy government intervention, says Mr. Bloom. If you can't even mandate face masks, how are you going to mandate that people take a personal risk with a vaccine? I can't imagine that being politically viable. Oh, well, he just hasn't been paying attention. Let's kick off our recap of some of the earlier events in the week with a Bolshevik Revolution update, which seems to have been kicked off officially with the COVID-1984 pandemic and lockdown, the deliberate implosion of the biggest debt bubble in human history, followed by increasingly violent rioting and looting and mugging and now murdering all across America. It's starting now even to spread out like a cancer from the leftist hellholes. And yes, that too is obviously part of the continuing Bolshevik Revolution. I'm really getting sick and tired of doing these kind of stories, folks, but guess what? They've only just begun, even though it's been obvious for years that they were coming. So we'll work up to some of the big nasty in a minute, but begin by first remembering it always starts with the little nasty, the kind of stuff that you see in Swamp Central, like Washington, D.C., or in Russia, 1917, or on the streets of Berlin early in the Nazi regime. This story I've heard several times over the last 24 hours, but the version I'm looking at comes from Christina Layla, the Gateway Pundit, a Black Lives Matter protest, a.k.a. Communist Party USA, that began in Columbia Heights outside the district on Monday night, confronted white diners outside D.C. restaurants, yeah, we know why, booga, 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 with chants of white silence is violence, and demanding that white diners trying to eat their meal in peace instead act like good little slaves and show their solidarity with the revolution by raising their clenched fists. The black woman who led several hundred protesters through the D.C. Columbia Heights area demanded repeatedly that white protesters step forward. Whereupon the mob screamed in the face of, get this, a liberal white woman who's actually been participating with this movement, but decided at this point in time she wanted a meal, and they shouted, white silence is violence, demanding she raise her fist and show her solidarity. Chuck Modiano, young man seen screaming at the woman, identified himself as a reporter for Deadspin. How appropriate. And according to the Washington Post, the woman named Lauren Victor refused to raise up her fist in solidarity because she felt like she was under attack, probably because she was. She told WAPO she'd been marching with BLM for weeks, but she felt that something was wrong about the idea of being coerced to show support. Wow, folks, what an amazing insight. Quote, in the moment, it didn't feel right, said Victor, adding she could also understand their anger. I wasn't actually frightened, she said. I didn't think they'd do anything to me, which just shows that she doesn't read history, folks, or understand anything about mob violence. She added, I'm very much with them. I've been marching with them for weeks and weeks and weeks, an unquote. The BLM mob also harassed, screamed at, flipped off, and abused a young white couple sitting outside at an outdoor restaurant, outraged that they too would not raise the black power fist in solidarity with the communists. 2 points, folks, and we're seeing both of them play out now. Remember, after the brown shirts had served the purposes of the Nazi Party, they were some of the first to be dispatched. Look for that trend to really accelerate, probably even before the election. And the second point, I guess, is more of a question. What if this same mob was demanding a different symbol of support instead of a raised clenched fist? Like standing at attention, clicking your heels, raising your palm, and saying, Heil Hitler. Is there really any difference whatsoever? Not when it comes to the ideology, that's for sure, nor the methodology. From there, we'll go on to the kind of journalism, and I put that term in great big quotes, that helps to foster this kind of violence and destruction. And arguably more importantly, pacify the gullible until it's too late for them. From the leftist rag called the Daily Mail out of the UK, Still, though, folks, I look at them as a better source than the WAPO or New York Times, and they do have a lot of pictures and even video, which sometimes helps to smooth the gaps in the stilted reporting. Quote, two people have been killed and another wounded on the streets of Kenosha, Wisconsin, during a third night of unrest, as dramatic videos captured a gunman shooting at protesters during clashes with militia following a wave of looting. Unquote, and that last word is the closest they get to the truth here. Let me try the sentence as it probably could have been written from the perspective of those who understand what's going on. Two people have been killed and another wounded on the streets of Kenosha, Wisconsin, during a third night of violence and rioting, as dramatic videos captured an armed citizen shooting, apparently in self-defense, at muggers during clashes following a wave of looting. And by the way, they don't mention it, but I will. This follows the case of an elderly business owner the night before who tried to stop BLM thugs from burning and looting his business. He was beaten unconscious, and they left his store in flames. That video, too, is on the web. So back to the latest escalation. Suffice it to say, folks, that if you watch that video, which they do include, you can make a pretty good case for that second reading. It's the captions below the still photos, though, that really kind of irritated me. One shows a man kicking the fellow with the rifle, who has fallen down on the ground at this point, in the head. And the caption says, one pursuer took a flying kick at the armed man after he fell to the ground following a pursuit in the streets of Kenosha. Note that you don't see the word attempting to flee anywhere in here. But it's the second photo that really raises my ire. It shows another man whacking the fellow on the ground over the head with a skateboard. And the caption reads thusly, an armed man on the ground scuffles with a man with a skateboard standing over him who is about to be shot in the chest. And good for you, man on the ground with a rifle, because he very well may have killed you otherwise, especially with the help of those other people who are converging on you. The text of the story, at least, which follows by a whole bunch of column inches below all the photos and headlines, seems to come a bit closer to the truth. The video showed the man with the gun appearing to stumble, they wrote, and fall in the street, before one pursuer took a flying kick at the gunman, and the other appeared to strike him with a skateboard, yeah, that's how it looked to me, and tried to grab his weapon. The gunman fired three or four shots from a seated position, hitting at least two people, including one who fell over and another who stumbled away clutching his arm, according to the videos. And as the crowd scattered, the shooter stood up and continued walking down the street as police cars arrived, whereupon the man, with his rifle carried in a sling, put up his hands and walked toward the squad cars as someone yelled at police that he had just shot someone. Their headline, by the way, and the video, actually shows the armed white man walking away and saying, quote, I've just killed somebody. And here's where the story gets kind of, well, downright dodgy, as the Brits would say, folks. Despite having approached the cops with his hands raised and appearing to have turned himself in, Sheriff David Beth later told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that the shooter had yet to be identified or detained. Huh? Here's the money quote in this piece. Police said they feared that the shooting stemmed from a conflict between, quote, self-styled militias defending their properties and local businesses from looting amid unrest. Call it what it is, folks, riots over the shooting of Jacob Blake. The Daily Mail actually does post a very good still photo of the alleged rifle-carrying shooter, carrying the rifle, with this caption. The man is seen walking the streets of Kenosha carrying a weapon as, quote, self-styled militias sought to fend off looters. This image, they say, is believed to have been taken earlier in the evening prior to the shootings. They also have a picture of the man hurt as he was shot in the arm. And they don't actually say it in the text anywhere it counts, but one of the pursuers and attackers of the man who fell in the street was in fact carrying a pistol. Interesting, though, how he's not called a gunman or even an armed victim. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Online has some more interesting commentary about the so-called vigilante group. They're a militia, said Sheriff Beth. They're like a vigilante group, referring to a group that on Tuesday, calling itself the Kenosha Guard, asked members and followers on to Facebook to come downtown and be prepared to defend the city. Quote, any patriots willing to take up arms and defend our city tonight from the evil thugs? No doubt they're currently planning on the next part of the city to burn tonight. And that was followed by a later post aimed at the Kenosha Police Chief Daniel Miskinis that read in part, I ask that you do not have your officers tell us to go home under threat of arrest as you have done in the past. We are willing to talk to KPD and open a discussion. It's evident that no matter how many officers, deputies, and other law enforcement officers that are here, you will still be outnumbered. Earlier in the evening, says the Journal Sentinel, a reporter observed a group of armed men with long guns standing guard at a dry cleaning business on Sheridan Road near 59th Street, with some on the roof. Police told them to get off the roof, and one of the persons shouted back, "Officer, this is our business," whereupon the police seemed to back down. And even before the shooting, notes the paper, someone from Kenosha suggested to Sheriff Beth that he deputize ordinary citizens to help contain the unrest. Listen to this response. Quote, "I said, there's no way I'm doing that," said the so-called sheriff, which does kind of speak volumes. And I can't help but think that others who've watched the video seem to have a similar impression to your host. Commentator Vox Day called his blog entry, "Who Needs the Police?" noting that if they're not going to shoot the arsonists, looters, and rioters, eventually someone will. He wrote, "I saw the video on Twitter. It was a clear-cut case of self-defense, regardless of what side the guy with the rifle is on. He was running away from a pack of armed people chasing him, stumbled, and fell down, and then shot the three people who caught up to him and attacked him while he was on the ground. Notice that the attacker who was shot in the arm had a pistol on him." And here I think he nails it. This is something your host has been suggesting for, oh, I don't know, quite a few years now, given that it's actually part of the concept of the right to keep and bear arms. If local authorities, or any authorities for that matter, really ever did want to stop the violence, all they'd have to do is issue another order. They issue plenty of unconstitutional ones. How about one that actually comports with the right to keep and bear arms? Just tell people publicly that they're authorizing the use of lethal force to defend their property. In other words, not only to defend life, liberty, and property inside their homes, at least in some still free states, but when they're threatened with exactly the kind of violence now becoming epidemic. Which, says Vox Day, might help the rioters to realize what's happening if a few more of them are shot dead in the process of trying to terrorize innocent people. And of course, once it becomes obvious that those defending their homes and businesses won't face charges for doing so. Oops, more on that in just a second, as you may have heard. Funny, isn't it, how you always get more violence when those who are doing the rioting, looting, and killing realize they're not going to face any charges for doing so. Well, gee, Mark, I can already hear the historically illiterate leftist saying, who knows how bad it would get if we let people defend themselves with guns? Answer, not nearly as bad as it's going to. And eventually, but let's just hope and pray it's not already too late, those who still have a home left to defend, forget the businesses by that point, we'll wake up to the fact that that's the only alternative they have left. By Wednesday evening, though, 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, the man with the rifle on a sling, was arrested and charged with, get this, first-degree murder. And you really need to see the entire sequence on video. And it really isn't clear how it all started. Hey, folks, wouldn't it be interesting if we still had trial by jury in this country? Later that evening, Fox host Tucker Carlson took quite a bit of heat for telling it like it is, saying,
we do know why it all happened, though. Kenosha has devolved into anarchy because the authorities in charge of the city abandoned it. People in charge from the governor of Wisconsin on down refused to enforce the law. They stood back and they watched Kenosha burn. So are we really surprised that looting and arson accelerated to murder? How shocked are we that 17-year-olds with rifles decided they had to maintain order when no one else would?
Writes Vox Day, no doubt among many others, the Big Brother government in Wisconsin shouldn't be charging Kyle Rittenhouse with murder. They should be giving him a medal. Whereupon he points to the backgrounds of the three so-called victims whom the 17-year-old shot. The Daily Mail showed a lot of their family pictures, but didn't get to these details. The late Joseph Rosenbaum, convicted pedophile, who served 12.5 years in prison for sexual conduct with a minor. The late Anthony Huber, convicted domestic abuser, multiple counts, including assault with a deadly weapon, battery, false imprisonment, and strangulation and suffocation. Antifa only hires the best. And finally, the lone survivor, minus an arm, Gage Grosskreutz, a convicted burglar who was illegally carrying, a gun. But obviously that doesn't matter if you're far left. Hell, the mainstream media won't even report it. Concludes Vox Day, if Trump would really like to pick up a quick 5 points on Biden, all he's got to do is pardon the guy, invite him to the White House, and give him the medal Wisconsin won't. Oh, and would you like to hear something really interesting? I saw this in the comments from the Vox Day piece. GoFundMe canceled the fundraiser for Kyle Rittenhouse's legal expenses. There's a shocker. But this isn't. They're more than happy to fund the campaign for Anthony Huber, which has already raised $75,000 for the late strangler. Suffice it to say, this is the story we're going to have to keep up on, because the smoke is already getting thick. And we'll pick it up there when we get back. Stay with us.
you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip to the side of the beat, yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey. Hey, I'm gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust. When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and this is one of those weeks where the news has been so beyond insane that you have to start off with something that, while it's equally insane, is at least a little bit funny. And that has to do with the speaker for the traitors, in that case Nancy Pelosi, imitating the Black Knight from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, on behalf, of course, of her lord and master, Sir Joseph the Clueless. And this comes after earlier in the week when she called Republicans enemies of the state, their new normal communist tyranny. As Sprott's Money blog puts it, courtesy of places like Zero Hedge, Nasty Nancy has just joined the chorus of prominent far-left communists masquerading as Democrats and trying desperately to avoid placing the senile one, creepy quid pro Joe Biden, in front of the proverbial firing squad in a debate with President Trump. Although I am suggesting a more appropriate metaphor here. Quote, I don't think there should be any debates, she said on Thursday, one day after President Trump demanded Biden take a drug test before the two square off. Almost sounds like the president is looking to give the guy an out, doesn't it? I wouldn't legitimize a conversation with him, nor a debate in terms of the presidency of the United States, unquote. You do have to kind of wonder which him she's talking about, though. Meanwhile, Newsweek is peddling this, saying that Democratic strategists and supporters of the man who would be king, creepy quid pro Joe Biden, are urging him not to debate President Donald Trump in the lead-up to Election Day. No, not because he's incompetent and they don't want to see him reduced to a pulp behind the podium. Instead, they cite Trump's publicity stunts and disregard for the rules. But does anybody else remember the real cinematic parallel here? It comes from that scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail where the Black Knight dares to stand before the king and dares to challenge him to a fight. You can't see the video. It is a bit grisly, as Monty Python is wont to be. If you've ever seen it, I'm sure you'll remember. And the king really doesn't want to fight, but he ends up dismembering the pompous Black Knight, literally limb by limb.
So be it!
Yeah, oops, the Black Knight's missing an arm there. Graciously, the king allows him to bow out. But no!
Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've heard worse.
At this point in the parallels, the traitorous knave puts it this way. I think you will also belittle what the debates are supposed to be about. I mean, think about that, folks, in the context here. And they're not to be about skullduggery on the part of somebody who has no respect for the office he holds, much less the democratic process. You know, like people who put their hands on a Bible and lie and don't even know what form of government we were supposed to have before they completely undermined it. Still, though, the posturing continues, and one by one the limbs come off. Although I guess you could argue Pelosi's trying to protect her Black Knight from this kind of public dismemberment.
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look!
Just a flesh wound.
All right, in Biden's case, it's, look, you pedophile bastard, you have no integrity left, and no brains left either. Now, at this point, it's obvious. In that case, Nancy doesn't want any kind of a contest. She just wants to declare victory and move on. She concluded by saying that, well, each candidate needs to have separate conversations. That way, he can stay in the basement, read his teleprompter, and nobody knows whether or not it's a body double. Adding, quote, let that be a conversation with the American people, not an exercise in skullduggery.
Come here! What are you going to do, bleed on me?
I'm invincible!
You're a loony.
Yeah, but that still doesn't mean they can't run him for president. And then, of course, claim that he won, regardless of what the voters, the polls, or the Constitution say.
All right. We'll call it a draw.
Come, Patsy.
Oh, I see. Running away, eh? You yellow bastard! Come back here and take what's coming to you! I'll bite your legs off!
What's not as funny is that they'll muzzle you, force vaccinate you, destroy your livelihood and steal your firearms, and then bite off everything you have. The riots, of course, will continue and escalate, and those who attempt to stand up to the terrorism will evidently be the only ones that the PC police are going to go after. And as we're seeing, they may end up taking more than an arm and a leg from those that dare to fight back. Speaking of which, let's get this out of the way quickly. If you haven't heard about it, you should. I saw at least half a dozen screenshots of it the morning after it came out. Courtesy of Paul Joseph Watson, though, via Summit News, a CNN reporter, described the mayhem in Kenosha as, are you ready for this, mostly peaceful. Even as the video showed cars set on fire by rioters burning behind him, while gunshots echoed in the background. Meanwhile, as just about everybody notes, the Chiron at the bottom of the criminally negligent network feed said, fiery but mostly peaceful protests after police shooting. What a whopper, observed Watson. There have been no peaceful protests in Kenosha. Instead, every night's been a running battle between police and rioters. As Paul put it, next time somebody's house is burning down, I'm sure the scene will be described, at least by the leftist media, as fiery but mostly peaceful. And that follows a CBS News sycophant earlier in the week pulling a similar stunt when host Gayle King described a, quote, second day of peaceful protest, which is what Black Lives Matter is really all about.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I guess that means unless you count the car dealerships set ablaze, stores looted, and people trying to protect their businesses being viciously assaulted. By the way, has anybody not yet written off Portland, or for that matter, most of the left coast? Writes Brock Simmons for the Gateway Pundit, crime is skyrocketing as Portland police can no longer respond to calls amidst fatigue, record retirements, and, of course, a lack of resources for rioting. They were even already short-staffed before the communist uprisings began back in May. Appearing before the media on Tuesday, the still relatively wet-behind-the-ears new police chief, Chuck Lovell, the 8th Portland PD chief in just the last 6 years, who has jumped 4 ranks, too, to take the post, from lieutenant, bypassing captain, commander, assistant chief, and deputy chief, to take the top slot. Anyway, the new top cop divulged just how far the bureau there has sunk, explaining that at least 50 officers have retired just this month, calls for service wait in the queue for longer than 20 hours, and how only 4 officers were available to respond to calls throughout the city on Saturday. I've seen as many as 80 calls holding, he said, noting that some of them waited for about 20 hours, depending upon the staffing. And if you get a shooting or something that requires a lot of resources, well, there's just no one to go sometimes. And here's the understatement that he wrapped up the quote with, we're a lean agency. Here's the question that Simmons properly asks. Why did he decide to openly broadcast that to the public? The fact that the police can't respond, and basically all he's doing is telling criminals that everybody else out there is fair game, in a city that's largely, of course, been pre-disarmed. Except, as usual for the leftist hellholes, the thugs. As a result, notes the piece, Portland saw more shootings in July, hey, I thought they were gun-free, than any other month in 30 years. August started off with a shooting that involved 150 rounds fired, and another case, a robber shot someone who tried to intervene. There was even a shootout between street racers, who now know they can take to whatever streets they want. While the Portland police Twitter feed shows stabbings, shootings, robberies occurring across the city every day, often with multiple shootings in a single day.
Just a flesh wound.
Oh, and guess who the left-wing mayor blames? Yeah, folks, they may tolerate you having your businesses looted and burned and your family gang-raped, but when it comes to a firm stance on crime, as KGW puts it, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler released a statement saying that he will not tolerate hate speech and the damage that does in our city. And I guess that's what muzzles are for. This one came out last weekend, but it fits into the category of other stuff Big Brother's media doesn't want you to hear. Like when Hollywood actress Rose McGowan went off against the far left and dropped a huge bomb on the Democrat parade, saying, quote, I was raped by a top Democratic donor. Hillary Clinton shut down NBC's expose of HW, presumably that means Harvey Weinstein, with one call from her spokesperson. I strongly believe Joe Biden is a rapist. DNC had Bill Clinton, serial abuser of young women, Perrin, Epstein, and others, speak. You want me to be pro-Dem? I know more than you will ever know about their evil. You can hide behind your convenient morality. I won't. The tweet had over 65,000 likes after less than 12 hours, said the Gateway pundit. Anybody else remember, folks, when the far left stood behind lies like, believe the woman? Well, obviously, it kind of depends now, doesn't it? But while people are rightfully concerned about the damage being done by the destruction, on purpose, but partly as a cover-up of the rule of law, the Federal Reserve continues their carnage under cover of that smokescreen. The widely anticipated Jackson Hole meeting, well, virtual Jackson Hole meeting anyway, in COVID America, may have disappointed stock market junkies a bit, but hey, it's kind of hard to tell with all the manipulation going on, and that seems to be the major point that's being made today. For those who missed the main event on Wednesday, said Sprott's Money Blog, even though it was a speech whose content was widely anticipated, Thursday morning, Fed Chair Jerome Powell announced that the FOMC has adopted a flexible form of average inflation targeting, and that's the key outcome of their monetary policy framework review. Another piece from Zero Hedge said that the Fed Chair's speech appears to be somewhat disappointing to investors, given his lack of enthusiasm for driving inflation higher fast. And they quote Bloomberg Intelligence Chief, U.S. rate strategist Ira Jersey, who said, with Chairman Powell's prepared remarks at Jackson Hole short on details, the market appears concerned that the Fed won't dramatically shift policy as was expected. And while it's still possible for a final framework release to create a bear steepening of the curve, today's reaction appears to be a reversal of some positions that would have benefited from longer-term inflation and growth expectations rising. And the markets reacted, at least initially, ominously, with the dollar being dumped, while gold and bonds jumped. But those blips were basically short-lived, and it looks like the plunge protection team is at least still on the job. Gold, for example, was higher for a bit, but now it's down about an equal amount, about 1.3%. Same thing for silver. As Eric Sprott puts it, the reason may be that the new FOMC statement includes dovish revisions to their approach to both employment and inflation objectives. The biggest changes on the inflation side, the statement notes that they now seek to achieve inflation that averages 2% over time. Trouble is, they just don't tell you how long that time is, because they don't want you to be able to figure there's a mathematical formula behind this or anything. Although they assure the markets that if inflationary pressures were to build, like say, if somebody printed a few extra trillion dollars, the Fed would, quote, not hesitate to act, unquote. When it came to employment changes, the language ledger domain was, well, less than legendary. The new policy will be informed by assessment of, quote, shortfalls of employment from its maximum level rather than deviations, the language previously used. Writing for the Vampire Squid, Goldman Sachs, Jan Hatzius said in his postmortem that the developments are, quote, a significant dovish long-term shift for the Fed, but one roughly in line with expectations. And he went on to note that the new policy, quote, introduces an element of make-up inflation, but characterizes the approach as flexible and stops short of a hard formulaic commitment, saying that they simply intend to likely imply inflation moderately above 2% for, quote, some time. How's that for wishy-washy, folks? I bet you it's more than some time, and I'll bet you ultimately it ends up being quite a bit higher than 2%, unless you say per month. Moreover, though, the statement continues to note that the Fed will respond to, quote, risks to the financial system that could impede the attainment of the committee's goal. Yep, the real mandate, says Hatzius, is that the Fed intends to keep markets levitated. And of note, says Hatzius, neither Powell's speech nor the revised statement noted any meaningful changes arising from the tools or communication practices of the review. Thus, according to Goldman, this means that there are no major official changes in any of those areas. And this, they said, was a surprise relative to our expectations that the FOMC would add yield caps and targets to the toolkit in principle, but without expressing any intention to use them anytime soon, unquote. And how's all of this, folks, for an agency that shouldn't really even exist if we actually had a constitution, honest weights and measures, or the rule of law? Yeah, I know. I really shouldn't have said agency. It's a public-private partnership. Mostly private, and certainly not a partnership with anything actually American. Goldman expects that the biggest changes coming out of this will be in forward guidance and asset purchase programs that will now probably come at the September FOMC meeting, earlier, before the election, as opposed to the previous expectations of November. Michael Every, writing for Rabobank, noted that the real hole in Jackson Hole is a total absence of what he called political economy, writing, "You can fiddle with targets and acronyms all you want, but the real problems are structural and hence political, and even some Fed economists recognize this." He gives some examples and goes on to note that, sarcasm aside, we are back to political economy, because politicians may have the power to deal with social transformation, concentration of wealth in just a few hands, massive inequality, qualities, competition issues, and all of that, or they do if they're not listening to economists and central banksters who won't address these issues because, quote, economics is a science and not political. Yeah, sure, and there's the real hole in Jackson Hole. What the Fed really just announced was a policy of never-ending monetary accommodation. By changing to an average inflation targeting platform that averages 2% over time, and that, of course, allows for overshoots. But, notes Tyler Durden, the Fed's credibility is certainly on the line, given that the market has priced in inflation expectations well below 2% for the next 30 years, and it has a decade-long record of misses in achieving its inflation mandate. Oh, don't worry, folks. They'll make up for it and eventually get that average right on up there. The pragmatic Michael Every suggests this. If inflation and wages begin to rise substantially, recognize that the Fed will, quote, just hold another Jackson Hole speech and change its operating framework again. Maybe the best commentary on the day comes from Michael Meharry at ShiftGold.com. It may actually predate the Fed announcement, but arguably that doesn't matter. In simple terms, he begins, the dollar is losing value and dollar debasement is driving the rising price of gold. And that's not a narrative you typically hear on the Waystream financial networks, but there seems to be a growing awareness that the dollar and the system based on it just might be in trouble, even in the mainstream investment world. Why, we've even seen Warren Buffett make a recent bet on gold, and Goldman Sachs has warned that the dollar could be in danger of losing its reserve status. Now he writes, Wells Fargo has weighed in, warning in a new report that the bull run in gold, quote, signals a growing lack of trust in the world's monetary system, unquote, and gee, do you think? Speaking of lack of trust, this one's interesting, even if it's again not surprising. The Centers for Deadly Contamination, or maybe it's the controlled death of a currency nowadays. Anyway, that particular public-private partnership has walked back their latest change to testing guidance, caving, it would seem, to pressure from the socialists in various governors' mansions. Why, just this week, in guidelines posted Monday, the agency said close contacts of COVID-1984 patients, quote, do not necessarily need a test. Well, unless they're vulnerable, or a local Big Brother health official recommends it. Do we need more testing or not? What's that squealing of stuck pigs I hear? Dr. Mengele himself weighed in, expressing his dismay that the recent guidance was finalized without his input. Who do they think they are? And this, says Zero Hedge, followed stronger condemnations from governors around the country. All of them Democrats, of course. And now on Thursday, the CDC has already buckled and issued a clarification that mostly walks back their guidance. The New York Times summarizes the hoo-ha this way. The walkback was leaked to them, whereupon they said the directors of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, SICC, have scaled back the agency's recommendation advising some people not to get tested after exposure to the novel coronavirus, now saying, again, that, quote, testing may be considered for all close contacts of confirmed or probable COVID-19 patients. Big flipping deal. Save yourself a lot of grief, folks, and maybe even an infection by flipping a coin. You'll probably get a more accurate answer at far less risk on every front you can think of, and chances are it's even more repeatable. On a different disaster front, Hurricane Laura made landfall early Thursday morning as a Category 4 major hurricane with maximum sustained winds of 150 miles per hour near the Texas-Louisiana border. There was heavy damage in the vicinity of Lake Charles, Louisiana. Between 300,000 and 500,000 people were without power in that part of Louisiana and adjoining Texas. and a huge chemical fire has erupted on the west side of Lake Charles, causing gases and smoke to plume over I-10, while officials warn of a possible chlorine leak. Meanwhile, again from one of the variations on Riot Central, Minneapolis, any excuse to riot, says the headline, where violence erupted one more time in the larger of the Twin Cities overnight, with video showing angry demonstrators, yeah, the peaceful kind, you know, burning down businesses, rioting, and looting, following misinformation, some of us might say fake news, about the killing, that was the term used, of a black homicide suspect. Rumors spread online that he'd been killed in a police shooting, but as it turns out, according to surveillance video, the man shot himself in the head. Whereupon a cop rushes to his aid, and off-camera, bystanders can be heard accusing the cops of shooting the now already dead victim. So bust down the doors to the stores and get yourself some souvenirs. Saks Fifth Avenue was among the stores on the Nicollet Mall that were looted in the aftermath. And we'll follow that up with a story that, again, may not get a whole lot of coverage from the waste stream. From the Epoch Times, Jacob Blake. Remember that name? Some folks do, even though they'd rather have the goodies. And if this story goes away, you can rest assured there will be other excuses to continue the revolution. He had a knife in his car, say investigators, when he was shot by police, according to the Wisconsin Department of Justice, which made the announcement on Wednesday. Blake, age 29, was black, of course, and was shot 7 times Sunday afternoon by an officer responding to a domestic incident. In an update on the investigation into the shooting, the department said officers were responding to a 911 call from a woman who said her boyfriend was at her house, but he was not supposed to be there. During an incident, and before he was a poster child for rioting, officers tried to arrest Blake, who had a warrant out for sexual assault. Officers struggled with Blake behind his vehicle, tased him, but then he escaped, walked around the vehicle, and opened the driver's side door, where there was a knife. Quote, during the investigation following the initial incident, Mr. Blake admitted that he had a knife in his possession. DCI agents recovered a knife from the driver's side floorboard of Mr. Blake's vehicle, but a search of the vehicle located no additional weapons, said the state DOJ. Two quick related stories. The mother of the man who was shot by police over the weekend in Wisconsin City forcefully denounced the rioting that's taken place in the wake of the shooting and in her son's name, said Julia Jackson, mother of Jacob Blake, on Tuesday. My family and I are very hurt and, quite frankly, disgusted. And as his mother, please don't burn up property and cause havoc and tear down your own homes in my son's name. You shouldn't do it. It's not helping Jacob, she added. It's not helping Jacob or any of the other men or women who've suffered in these areas. And demonstrating the level of integrity involved here from the Black Lives Matter crowd, Sean King, who doesn't really actually look black in the pictures, but he's called a prominent Black Lives Matter activist, threatened late Tuesday to start just randomly naming various Kenosha police officers if the city's PD doesn't identify the actual officer who shot Jacob Blake. Quote, to the Kenosha PD, if you don't name the officer who brutally shot Jacob Blake on Sunday, we'll simply begin naming officers from your department who may or may not be him. I haven't said much about what went on at the RNC last night. Quite frankly, there wasn't much to talk about. There was this, though. But you do have to ask, we wait 4 years, and this is all we get when it comes to lock her up, lock him up, lock them up? This is Rick Grinnell, former acting director of national intelligence, sick. And I have to ask, is this all we're going to get?
Today, the Democrats blame a global pandemic that started in China on President Trump. And they still blame Russia for Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016. As acting director of national intelligence, I saw the Democrats' entire case for Russian collusion. And what I saw made me sick to my stomach.
All of us who've seen any of it, folks, can say that. And we still haven't seen what we expected to.
And what I saw made me sick to my stomach. The Obama-Biden administration secretly launched a surveillance operation on the Trump campaign and silenced the many brave intelligence officials who spoke up against it. They presented bogus information as facts. They lied to judges. Then they classified anything that undermined their case.
Yeah, so some of us would say, lock them up. Here's the big finale, where he says that with the Democrats, you never know who's calling the shots.
But with Donald Trump, you always know exactly who is in charge. Because the answer is you. You're in charge. With Donald Trump and Mike Pence in the White House, the boss is the American people.
Well, gee, I'm really glad they finally cleared that up. In that case, lock him up. Lock her up. Lock him up. Quit destroying the American economy with the COVID-1984 pandemic, unmuzzle the populace, and honor your oaths, all of you. And yeah, folks, don't hold your breath.